This is our last gathering for the year. I can't believe it, but it's really great to share it with everyone, and great to see lots of people here. Kylie and I went to the movies this week, last week, and we saw the new Thor movie. Who's seen the new Thor movie? Yeah, it's very, very funny. I'm not really into superhero movies, but it's directed by the New Zealand director who created Hunt for the Wilder People. The Wilder Water People? The Wilder People. And it's a choice movie. Anyway, you'll have to see it. There's this fantastic, hilarious rock man from New Zealand, this huge, enormous giant with this teeny-weeny New Zealand accent, and it's hilarious. But that's not really the point of this talk. Just before the movie, there was an advert that came on about the spirit of Christmas, and it really stood out to me because I was thinking about this talk for today, and I was thinking, hey, it was a beautiful advert, but it also really connected with what I'd like to talk about. So hopefully you'll be able to hear it. We've been playing around with our technologies, and it's a bit different today, but let's have a watch. I watched that advert, and I actually think it's a really beautiful advert in so many ways. You know, it speaks of humanity, it speaks of friendship, of community, it speaks of joy, of the highs and lows of being close together and being distant and far apart. I suppose it speaks of beauty and fun and friendship, and all of these things come from God, don't they? I mean, they're beautiful things, connectivity and community. But there's also a central idea in the advert, because it is an advert, that there's something about our phones or our technology that is needed to connect all of these moments that you see in this thing. So, the phones do some incredible things, which the advert talks about. Phones help us create a record of our lives, of the special moments in our lives. They allow us to connect at a distance. They allow us to share moments again and again and again, even if we're away. I love some of the lines. We can be nose to nose, growing close. Moments can be made good in ways we didn't think we could. They're really quite beautiful ideas. And yeah, so it struck me. I mean, I love the idea of being nose to nose with those we love, even if we're at a distance. I mean, it's a really beautiful, poetic line. And the idea of having close friendships, even if we're apart. And to have the spirit of community all through Christmas, even if we can't have it right now. But there's something that also makes me feel uncomfortable about the way in which the message is presented, as much as it's beautiful and it represents the heartbeat that God puts in us. And that's that it's almost like, in the advert at least, we can't have those moments. We can't be nose to nose. We can't have community and connection unless we have the phone in our hand. Like, a bit like we can be nose to nose with those we love, but only if we have a technology between those noses. You know, it makes me a bit uncomfortable. Does that make sense? And so there's this beauty in it, but there's also this kind of strange question. And so it connects with what I've been talking about over the last three sermons, which is the great discipleship challenge of our time, which I believe is the way in which we engage in digital technology as disciples of Jesus. And if you remember, the aim of the series has been to rethink our relationship with digital technology, both practically and theologically, and to ask, to think through and reflect on whether or not there are one or two habits that God might be wanting us to shift. And the key question is, are my digital habits worth imitating? So we know that to be a disciple of Jesus is to be a learner, and that the way we make disciples is by copying one another much more than what we learn in our minds. It's about the behaviours we imitate. And so the question for discipleship and technology is, are my habits worth imitating? But today what I'd like to talk about is social media and discipleship. I put in Google, Jesus likes me, and this is what I came up with. So I thought, it's a very ridiculous statue. Apparently there's a statue somewhere in the world that actually is that, and I just photoshopped it, as you can do on technology. But look, when I look at the idea of social media and discipleship, so social media being Facebook, Pinterest, Twitter, Snapchat, Instagram, you know, all these different platforms, WhatsApp, that we might connect with in order to be nose to nose and face to face using our technologies, I'm interested in how they relate to discipleship and how they relate to what it means to be a follower of Jesus. So to start with, I always like to ask a question. And the first one is, well, what is great about social media and what maybe do you feel uncomfortable about in the same way that I do? I mean, who here uses some type of social media? Yeah, so a lot of us. So what do you love about social media to start with? Just one or two comments if anyone has any thoughts. The connections, yep. Photos. And the photos, yeah, they're great.
I like that there's a conversation starter when you catch up with someone.
Yep, conversation starter when you...
I saw your new
pets. Yeah, we saw our little chickens. We've got chickens and we put on social media. Instantaneous, exactly, yeah, immediate. It's amazing, all around the world, which is amazing. Yeah, okay, so anything that is there anything that we feel uncomfortable about or that we wrestle with social media that we don't like? Pardon?
Oversharing. So reading about people's terrible day.
Yep. Reading about their terrible day. I feel your pain.
Reading about people's thoughts about things you didn't think they had.
Okay. Yep. Reading about their thoughts and finding them frightening, yep.
The whole idea that it sells that you want, like, your image, what other people think of you is important.
Yeah, so the image that others see and care about is being manicured and it matters.
Yeah.
The keyboard warriors it creates.
What, the keyboard wars? Yes, it does create them, doesn't it? I read somewhere that, you know, would you write that within punching distance of the person next to you? And maybe the answer is no. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, okay, so they'll be friends to you online but not face to face. Yeah, that's very interesting, isn't it? All right, so look, there's great and there's bad, there's good and there's not so good. So we're going to talk about social media and discipleship. So I thought by starting, I was very curious and I wanted to look at what is the promise of social media. Now, Facebook is the largest platform still, even though it's losing a little bit of market share compared to some other growing platforms. But the promise when I look at the Facebook homepage, and this is where you sign up, is Facebook helps you connect and share with the people in your life. Now, it's a really beautiful, rich and compelling promise to be able to connect and share. And obviously, with the image below, it's about people sharing as a network, sharing globally, sharing across cultures, instantaneously like we talked about, and being able to connect with those we love. So Facebook has 2.1 billion users the last time I looked online, and nearly half of them, I think it's about 46-47% log in every single day. So more than nearly a billion people log into Facebook every day. I mean, that is mind-blowing if you think about it. A billion users every day. And I think what it says is this is a very, very compelling promise. We all want community, don't we? We all want to feel connected with one another. We want to share our lives with people. We want to contribute to the world, and I think, and contribute to one another's conversations. And we want to feel like we are engaged in a network that is bigger than ourselves, which is why there's 2.1 billion people on Facebook. But the interesting thing is, as I was looking at this and reflecting on the promise of Facebook and how compelling it is, I kind of scanned across to the right, where it says, create an account. Oh, someone's WhatsApping you, are they? Okay, so create an account. And when you look here, it says, it's actually part of the promise and the value proposition of Facebook. It's free and always will be. And that really made me think as well, because I thought, wow, community, connection, and sharing with people in your life, and it's absolutely free. And it really made me question, is it free? I mean, can you have community and connection all around the world instantaneously in an amazing way and there to be absolutely no cost? And that is not just a fantastic promise, that is an unbelievable promise, don't you think? And so I really was curious about whether or not this is true, and so I went on a little bit of a journey to try to work out from the research to find out what was true and what wasn't based on what is happening in real time today. Now, just before I move on, it reminded me, Chris will laugh here, but it reminded me of a moment that I had with Chris a few months ago now, or a bit more. And this was just before Chris got baptized. So we were meeting, and we were meeting to talk about his baptism and about what what it would look like, and we prayed together before his baptism. And so Chris took me to this cafe that I hadn't been to. It was a bit bohemian, a bit like him, you know, a grungy type of thing. And so I looked at the menu, and I was going to eat breakfast, and I was really more interested in Chris than the breakfast. So I scanned through, but usually you would just say, well, I'll get, you know, I don't know, big breakfast. But there was no eggs and bacon. There was no big breakfast. There was no pancakes. And I'm like, oh gosh, I didn't understand half the ingredients on the menu. So the one menu item for breakfast I recognized was pho soup. So who here has had pho soup before? Yeah. So it's a beautiful Vietnamese beef noodle soup. It's got aromatic spices and flavors, and it's very simple and tasty. And being half Asian, I really like noodles for breakfast. So I ordered the soup, and we were chatting. And then the soup came out, and I looked at it, and I thought, oh, it looks really nice. And it smelled like pho, but it didn't quite smell the way it normally smells. And then I tasted it, and I'm like, this is kind of tastes like pho, but it just wasn't quite right. It was nice, but not quite right. And then I said, this is weird, Chris. And he's like, what's wrong? I'm like, I don't know. And I had a close look. I kind of stirred it around and looked at the meal. I'm like, there's no beef. And like, pho's a beef noodle soup. And he goes, well, of course there's no beef. It's a vegetarian cafe. And I'm like, oh, it's a vegan cafe. And I'm like, oh, how do you have a beef noodle soup with no beef? And then I thought, actually, pho is made of like stock, which is based on roasted beef bones. I thought, what's the stock made of? So I spoke to the waitress, and I said, can you tell me what's in this? And she said, oh, it's made of mushroom stock. I'm like, so it's a beef noodle soup with no beef and made of mushroom stock. So it was actually really tasty. It was tasty, and it was nice, but it wasn't real pho. In fact, we laughed. We said it was a fake pho, or we decided it was a fofo. So from now on, that will be my fofo soup. So we feel like the cafe, I won't name them, they need to name their order fofo soup. But anyway, the soup reminds me of the question I have around social media that I've just shown you before. You know, it was tasty, it was interesting, it smelt like pho, it looked like pho, and it kind of tasted like pho, but it wasn't quite pho. And I think we'll find with community that online communities are actually very similar. So if we're going to look at what the real deal is, you know, what is real community rather than pho community, we need to always go back to the scriptures and work out what's God's design and God's plan for community. So this scripture is one of the beautiful scriptures about community in the New Testament. Jesus has come to earth, he's died and he's come alive again. And what you see here is that the believers, the early church, get together and the church begins. And this is the image or the imagination of the early church. Now, I put the word koinonia here because the word fellowship, which I've highlighted, is the word koinonia. But it's a beautiful and rich and deep word that is far more than the kind of community you get when you have scones or coffee at the end of a church service. It's the kind of community you see in this passage, which I'd like to read and explore in a bit more detail. It actually means community, joint participation and sharing in common. And it's a rich and beautiful image. So, they devoted themselves to the apostles' teaching and to fellowship, or koinonia, to the breaking of bread and to prayer. Everyone was filled with awe at the many wonders and signs performed by the apostles. All the believers were together and had everything in common. They sold property and possessions to give to anyone who had need. Every day they continued to meet together in the temple courts. They broke bread in their homes and ate together with glad and sincere hearts, praising God and enjoying the favor of all people. And the Lord added to their number daily those who were being saved. It's such a beautiful and rich picture of community. So I've highlighted a few words here which really stand out for me. You see, it on the one hand, it sounds like the Facebook promise, connection, community, connection every day in the comfort of your own home. But on the other hand, it's a lot more costly and it's a lot more rich. So they devoted themselves to the apostles' teaching. So we see that there was to fellowship, to the breaking of bread. So that's real tangible bread with real tangible breadcrumbs. And to prayer. So it's a spiritual community. Everyone was filled with awe, the believers were together, and they had everything in common. So there was this commonality between those who connected with each other around Jesus. They sold property and possessions. You know, they sold land and possessions. You hear this in the story of Ananias and Sapphira later on. So it's far from free to participate in this type of community. And they gave to anyone who had need every day. So every single day they met together, and they did it in the temple court. So that was their expression of church gatherings. It's an effort, isn't it, to come here on a Sunday afternoon once a fortnight. It's an effort, and it takes energy to organize it. But they did it every single day. So this is high commitment. And then they broke bread, and they did it in their homes, but real homes. So they opened their doors, and they opened their houses, and they experienced smells and mess and screams and laughter and noise. And they did it with glad and sincere hearts as they ate together. They also praised God, and they enjoyed the favor of all people. So it was a spiritual community. It was a rich community. It was a committed community. When I look at that type of image of humanity, one which is spiritual, which is shared, one which is sacrificial and loving, connected, joyful, nose to nose, face to face with those we love, it's a really high bar that can only happen through the grace of God when we love Jesus together. But at the same time, it's real community rather than faux community. Can you see what a different image that is? So I want to hold that image up and remember what koinonia looks like. And now I want to look at some other questions I had, because I wanted to know whether the promise in Facebook that we looked at before, that Facebook helps you connect and share with the people of your life, whether or not that kind of community actually delivers in the same way as we read in the scriptures about God's people, the ecclesia, meeting together and being his people on a mission together. Okay? And so what I did is I looked up the research. I looked up a bunch of research articles, and there's actually quite a lot of research articles, so good, high-quality, longitudinal studies that have been done about Facebook and social media to find out what the research is saying about whether or not this promise actually occurs in real life or whether or not this is like a faux soup, a faux-faux. Okay? So I have three questions that I wanted to ask, hypotheses. And the first one is social media free? I mean, that's my first question. And the second question is, does social media strengthen relationships and community? And the third question is, does social media increase happiness? They're the promises. I wanted to find out if it's true based on the scientific, non-religious research. Are you interested in the answers? Yep. Okay, so let's go through quickly. Firstly, is social media free? We're gonna play a quiz, okay? True or false? Who thinks it's true? Hands up. Good. We needed someone. Who thinks it's false? Excellent. Okay, so it costs you nothing. We'll move on. Yeah, you get where I'm going. All right. Oh no, I should have practiced this. Okay, so the answer one, I don't believe social media is free. In the sense of cost, maybe, but in terms like monetary cost, but in terms of time, life, and impact, it's not free because it takes time away from real world relationships. So I'll show you a few stats. I did show you this research last fortnight, so I'll go through very quickly. So in 2007, the iPhone was released. And in 2012, the iPhone hit 50% saturation in the US market, and ever since then, culture has slid either up or down, cliffs and troughs in huge ways. So if you can look at here, the amount of times teenagers go out with parents has massively, massively dropped since 2012 and continues to drop. So what it means is as social media and iPhone use goes up, time with real community, real face-to-face friendships goes down. The average American teen spends 1 hour less per day with face-to-face friendships than the average millennial or the average Gen X or Boomer before them, and when they do spend time with their friends, media is part of that experience rather than it being unmediated friendship. That's quite a lot, an hour per day for your entire life. You think about that. That's a lot of community that you're not doing in exchange for online community and other activities. So a summary of the research is that we trade time. So as new media, so iPhones, smartphones, tablets, etc., and social media goes up, face-to-face friendships and exercise goes down, reading print media goes down heaps, religion, silence and solitude goes down even more. And all of those activities statistically increase your happiness, but new media may not do so. So I suppose in that sense it's not free. And I'll read one quote and then I'll move to the next point. So iGen teens are less likely to take part in every single face-to-face social interaction measured. So this is a researcher. Everything from small group or one-on-one activities such as getting together with friends to larger group activities such as parties. They include activities with no real aim, such as cruising in a car, and those that may have more of a goal in mind, such as going to see a movie. They include activities that might be replaced by online convenience, such as going to the shopping mall, and those that can't be easily replicated online, such as going out with friends. And here's the researcher's summary. For iGeners, online friendship has replaced offline friendship. So in that sense, there is a cost. Question two. Does social media strengthen relationships and community? I'll let you reflect on that for a second, then I want to go true or false. Does social media strengthen relationships and community? Who thinks true? Yeah. Okay, and who thinks false? Great. And I think you've all worked out that it is, I think it's nuanced. It is true, but I have yes, but. Just like you said, it's true and it's false. Well, it's true, but, as you said, Cheryl, it depends on how it's used. So social media does strengthen relationships in some circumstances, definitely. It's positive, it's rich, and increases community and connection, but it does less so than face-to-face friendships, and there is a but in how it is used. So this is really interesting. So there have been thousands and thousands of research studies over many, many decades to show that when you have increased social connection and increased social connectedness, so basically better community, you live longer, you are healthier and happier in almost every score. Okay, so having friendships and community is an incredibly smart thing to do if you care about your health. But these studies have all been done on face-to-face community and face-to-face relationships. So now the research is catching up and comparing what the consequence of online relationships are compared to face-to-face relationships. And it's interesting. So what it's finding is in some circumstances and with some types of use, social media does increase connectedness. It complements face-to-face relationships and face-to-face connectivity, which is fantastic. It's beautiful. And so what I mean by that is you need to be an adult or at least an old teenager, okay? So if you're between the ages of about 13 to 15, 13 to 16, it doesn't. And I'll talk about that a bit later on. But if you're an adult, it certainly can increase your social connectedness. If you use it in moderation, okay? So if you use it for more than 2 hours a day, it definitely doesn't. It has a whole lot of negative effects and does the opposite of more social connectedness, okay? But I'd say probably from logical common sense, if you use it more than about an hour a day, it starts to have negative effects. But under an hour a day, it can increase connectedness. So again, it's a nuanced answer. Yes, but. You need to, from the research point of view, be an active social media user and not a passive social media user. So what that means in the research is an active social media user is engaged in creating stuff. You add your photos, you write posts, you create stuff online and share it with those you love. A passive user spends their time scrolling through other people's news feeds and liking other people's stuff lots and lots. So the research says active use is much healthier for us than passive use, even though most of us tend to be drawn towards passive use. Does that make sense? And the last thing is, we need to not be prone to envy or social comparison, either positively or negatively. So what I mean by that is, if you're someone who compares yourself with other people, either positively, hey, I'm better than you, or negatively, oh, their life is better than me, both of those things reduce your happiness and reduce the benefits of social connectedness. So I suppose the yes but is, use it in moderation as adults. Don't overuse it. Don't trade time for real-life relationships, because as soon as you do that, you lose the real benefits of social connectedness. But let it complement the relationships that you have already and be actively involved in what you do. So, does that make sense? Okay, so the last one, does social media increase happiness? True or false? And again, I'm deliberately making these kind of binary questions just to make you think. But who thinks true? Who thinks false? All right. Pretty much the research says that social media makes you unhappy. And it increases loneliness the more you use it. Again, you can use it in moderation and it will help your happiness, but generally it reduces it. So this is where there's been lots and lots of studies which I've read on social media, and it's really quite interesting. So firstly in, what have we got here? Yeah, I'm more likely to feel lonely. So these are teenagers. iPhone was released in 2007. Look at what happens here. The statement, I often feel left out of things and a lot of times I feel lonely, massively increases after 2012. In teenagers, between particularly the ages of 15 and 16. There seems to be something about social networking that massively increases loneliness the more that teenagers use it, particularly girls. So girls are prone to social comparison and to kind of... Girls have always used words to bully one another, but social media makes that even more. And it also increases the body image issues at a time when girls are actually working at what it means to be young women. Does that make sense? So the age is really important. Gene Twenge says iGen is on the... before I do that. So two Facebook studies. One Facebook study texted people 5 times a day, which sounds crazy to me, for a few weeks, and basically tracked their mood. And it compared the mood with their Facebook use. And what it found is when people use Facebook, they feel less happy within the first hour after using it. And if they continue to use Facebook more, they feel more unhappy. So then another study in 2016 took 500 people off of Facebook and kept 500 people on Facebook and as a control, and wanted to work out what happens to people's happiness if you get off of Facebook. And they tracked people before, they tracked people after, and their results were quite conclusive. Like statistically, if you get off of Facebook, you'll feel happier, you'll feel less lonely, and you'll have less envy of other people. It's really quite a high-quality study. It's really interesting. So get off of Facebook and stop liking people and you'll actually feel happier as an overall kind of experience. We haven't looked at studies in Instagram, Pinterest and other kind of stuff like Snapchat. It hasn't been around long enough for people to be intentionally studying it, but it's an interesting research. So just to finish, the Gene Twenge says, iGen is on the verge of the most severe mental health crisis for young people in decades. And on the surface though, everything is fine. And the last few stats, and again, this is teenagers, so it doesn't relate to adults, but particularly the 13 to 16-year-old age group on social media, 31% of 31% more 8th to 10th graders in America felt lonely in 2015 compared to 2011, so that's a monumental change in 4 years. In terms of depression, 56% more teens experienced a major depressive episode in 2015 compared to 2010. It's a very short period of time. And suicidal, this is the really terrible stat. Teens who spend more than 3 hours a day on electronic devices are 35% more likely to have at least one suicide risk factor. And in the States, it's a terrible stat. The numbers are low, but the teen suicide rates have doubled since 2012. It's really quite horrendous. So that's the sad news. And I'll just quickly finish by the research part by saying what's going on. And basically, social media is decreasing happiness because you generally put a happy image of yourself online. Does that make sense? You tend to put a happier life online than a sadder life, and therefore you have this fear of missing out. Cyberbullying is really harmful, particularly for teenagers in those younger years, and it makes them feel like they can't escape the bullies where they used to be able to escape when they came home. Social media takes time from activities that increase happiness, such as face-to-face friendships, exercise, religion, and reading books. And it also reduces sleep because the majority of teenagers are sleeping with their phone by their bed and waking up regularly to Snapchat or text their way through the night. And so the average teen sleeps 1 hour less than we did at the same age. And all that combined creates mental health problems. Now, that's the really sad message, and I'm sorry to put a dampener on your day. Just before we move into the last section, which is what do we do about it in a really positive way, are there any questions or thoughts? I suppose reflections. So let's just have 1 minute of silence and just to ask God, is there anything that stands out to me personally from what I just shared with you? Would one or two people want to share anything? Any questions or reflections? Yeah. So you're strengthening a few relationships, but not diluting the ones that you have. Yeah. Yeah. That sounds great. Sounds really good. Maybe one other person. Any insights or reflections? Yeah. Do you see this in teaching? So, I mean, it's not all bad news. I suppose the hard news, particularly for us as parents raising children and entering that new age, is that there are some challenges, but if we know about them, we can do some amazing things with them and enjoy the best of technology. In fact, so what I've got here is, I mean, I don't want to give the impression that social media is bad, because there is some amazing, beautiful stuff with it. It's really about being a disciple and a learner, not a passive consumer. It's about being a thinker and a plan, like thinking through how we use it, not just taking it on and hoping everything will be fine. Does that make sense? And so, I mean, this is a picture of Zoom. I mean, I love Zoom, which is like a Skype, and it's conferencing. So I coach people online in my business, and it's incredible. And I could never do the business that I run without social media, without social connection and networking. I'm in a huddle online, and the person who coaches me is Mike Breen at the moment, with a bunch of other guys from the States. There's a guy in Argentina who lives in the middle of nowhere, a bishop in Argentina, and someone else in Rhode Island. I've got these amazing people that input into my life every single week because of the social connection and social media that I use. It's just an unbelievable thing that we can do this in our day and age. I love WhatsApp. I mean, we have, I connect with family, I connect with friends. Our missional community, the Stones community, has a WhatsApp group, and we share prayer requests, we give Bible passages, we tell each other about what's going on, we connect with each other, we organize stuff around each other's lives through that medium. So I'm so grateful and thankful. It allows us as individuals who live busy lives to have some type of daily connection like the people in Acts had. So technology is allowing us to do incredible, amazing, wonderful things. We just need to think through it as adults. Yeah? Okay, so what might it look like to move forward in a positive way? And the biblical principle, one that comes from Dallas Willard, he used a different term, but basically it's any spiritual discipline is that you need to feast and you need to fast. And I think with digital technology, that's the same answer as any area of life. We need to have habits and practices of feasting and habits and practices of fasting. And as we do that, we enjoy the best of connectedness, nose-to-nose, face-to-face, without losing the worst of it. So what I mean by feasting is we can use, when we find rich and positive and engaging and healthy ways to use our digital platforms, let's use them and enjoy them and celebrate them as something that God has given us, and celebrate that stuff. Yeah? Let's feast on it. So I feast on technology when it helps me to love God with my heart, soul, and strength and mind, and when it helps me to love others as I love myself. And digital technology allows me to do that in many, many situations. So what I mean by that is, you know, if you have a Bible reading plan and it motivates you, awesome. Use it online. If you've got online coaching, online communities that strengthen your relationships and help you grow, let's do that and celebrate God in those spaces. You know what I mean? I love enjoying movies, download them from, you know, I stream stuff from Google Play and we watch it as a family. It builds community. I love the beauty and richness of music that I download from iTunes. I love getting stuff done on my productivity apps and email and Evernote and things and all these other apps and programs that actually increase my capacity to do the things that God has asked me to do. So none of that's bad. We should celebrate and feast on the things that are good. And I'm sure you can all think of things that you want to feast on, yeah? In terms of the last thing, fasting, there are some things, though, where we want to reduce the risks of social media that we see in the research when we are passive, when we dive into it and exchange some of what is good about relationships for what isn't good. And to do that, there are a few things I do. I fast from technology, so one of the big things for me is I charge my phone outside of my bedroom now. So I used to charge it in my bedroom, and I found that I was tempted every single day to basically go to bed after scanning emails or looking at the news or just watching dumb videos that didn't increase my joy and just seemed to waste time. You know what I mean? And then I'd wake up in the morning and first thing I'd do is check my email and actually look at the work of the day. So now that I charge my phone outside of my bedroom, which is a form of fasting, I finish by reading or by thinking or talking to Kylie, and I start the day with just quietly lying in bed praying and reading the scriptures. So it's a better way to start the day. The habit of creating that distance has been really useful. So that's one small habit that I've found useful, and I think it's a really helpful one. Just buy an alarm clock and don't use your phone. Another one is to delete addictive apps. So if you find that you're constantly just in an addictive, bored, passive way, flicking onto some type of social media app on your phone or on your tablet, and it's actually just drawing your attention away from healthy, good, real relationships, then just delete them from your phone. You can still use the social media, but just be more intentional in how you do it and make it harder for you to log on and just scroll and scan when you're bored or when you've got nothing to do. So I found that really useful, and a lot of people do. And killing the notifications that make you constantly look at your phone, even if it's a good thing like WhatsApp and a community group. I mean, our community group will text each other 40 times a day sometimes, and I don't want to look at my phone, just randomly have my interruption broken 40 times in the day. I'd rather look at it 3 times and actually work out what people are saying. So that, for me, that works better. And the last one is take a digital Sabbath. So we talked about the idea of turning off your technologies once a week and not to reject your tools, but to give you a bit of space and allow you to have a bit of freedom away from your devices to give you some time to reflect and to enjoy life outside of the digital world. So some of those ways have been helpful to help me fast. And the last thing is particularly for parents, because I know a lot of us are parents. There are some really good research-based ideas for teens, and some of our kids are heading into teenhood. So, I mean, Naomi hits, so my daughter is, Naomi is 10 years old now, and she'll hit, well, she's rapidly moving towards high school. When she does, the majority of her friends will have a phone, smartphone, and the majority of her friends will be on social media. And that is a real challenge for me. Like, I really wrestle with that, because I wrestle that I have reservations about doing that, about following culture, following the crowd, and yet I'm really fearful of saying no and making my daughter hate me or rebel or say I'm being too hard or too strict. It's a really big challenge. And so I suppose my prayer is that if we can pray through this and navigate it and compare it with Koinonia and actually do it as a community, then we can support each other no matter what we choose, but it can be a conversation rather than something that we all just do because everyone else does it. One of the things I reflect on, actually, is that, you know, I want to help Naomi and my other kids. I want to help them enjoy the online world safely. And I think for me that means slowing them down compared to culture. Not saying no, but just slowing them down in some areas where it's unhealthy to engage where everyone else is. And if that sounds harsh, we've just got to remember that Steve Jobs, the one who made the iPhone, said famously that he does not allow his teenagers to use iPhones or iPads because it's bad for their health. So, you know, let's be more like Steve Jobs and hang around the dinner table and talk about history and geography with his kids. That's what he says he does. And less like the school parents around us that say everyone has it, so therefore we should. Does that make sense? So it's a real tension, and I realize it's going to be a question that we're going to have to wrestle with, which is why I call it the great discipleship challenge of our age. Let's wrestle with this as a community. Let's not damage our relationships with our children, but let's bless them, and let's not forget that that I just don't want my kids to grow up feeling depressed, anxious, and lonely. And I need to listen to the scientific research. Yeah. And so the way to do that, the research recommendations, the best ones I've seen say basically hold off. Don't say no, but hold off if you can for as long as possible on giving your children social media access and their own smartphone. Particularly around the ages of 13 and 15, and particularly if they're girls, big risk factors. I know that's hard, but it's when they're vulnerable. Another one is when you do give your kids phones and when you give your kids their own social media accounts, just set clear guidelines and be active in your parenting and monitor the use. So recommendations are create a social contract. So talk about what's okay and what's not, what are the risks, what aren't. So there's good communication around the tools we give our children. Look at the safe social media options. So generally, Facebook, Instagram, they're actually some of the worst ones. I mean, not Tinder, obviously, but some of the worst ones are the ones that we use. In terms of kids' safety, probably things like WhatsApp and Snapchat are a little bit safer for young kids because you don't create this near permanent account and record of your life, and so there's less potential to kind of manicure your image and become an overly conscious, and the groups are more contained and tight-knit. So think about which accounts and which social media accounts you actually sign your kids up to. Do role-playing scenarios to teach your kids how to respond in difficult situations like grooming or pornography. I mean, the stats say that if you've got a boy and they're 15-year-old, they will be shown hardcore pornography at school or on the bus or in the playground with other people's phones. So you can't avoid it. So let's have the conversations. Hey, when your mate comes up to you and says, hey, look at this, and it's a really full-on, aggressive, nasty, adult type of thing, what do you do? Let's role play with our kids and protect them, give them skills and tools to live in the world we live in. Use monitoring software. There's great software to limit the amount of time our kids have on their phones once they have them. And the last one is the recommendations say it's really, really healthy to not let your kids charge their phones at night in their bedrooms. Basically, let them sleep and have a phone bin, and the whole family puts it in there, and then you go to sleep, and then you can use it in the morning. You know what I mean? So they're not big recommendations. They're actually quite sensible, but it just means that let's engage as disciples, as learners, take the best of connectedness, but not get sucked into saying, hey, it'll be all right, I'll do what everyone else does. There's a lot in that, and I hope that is useful. Please speak to me if you have particular questions around any of those recommendations. But as a prayerful spiritual community, let's support each other and make this a conversation that isn't just for three sermons, but is part of our culture where we support each other, we wrestle together. When we make mistakes, and we absolutely will, we give each other grace and support and love each other. And when we have questions and challenges, let's try to use the collective wisdom and spiritual maturity in our community to help us raise our kids in a beautiful, rich, and loving way. Does that sound good? So what I'd love, just to finish, is for everyone to reflect on two things, which we always reflect on in silence. If you have a pen and paper, or if you just want to remember it, feel free. But what is God saying to you? What is one thing that stands out from this talk, something that God might be saying to you or stirring up in your heart, something that might strike you as being significant? And what is one thing you might like to do about it? I'm not going to ask anyone to share that, but just have a minute between you and God to reflect on what does it mean for me, what's God saying, what might I do about it, and then we're going to enter communion. So as we head into communion, this is where we talk to God face to face. We bring our stuff to Him. I remember the many passages where Jesus says, "Do not fear," and the Christian life is one of alarms, is one of not fearing. We are to be of the world, but not in it. But we are to trust that we have an advocate walking alongside of us. So Jesus knows what it means to be human. He knows the joys and complexities of our age because He died, but He also came alive again. He is the living God. He knows what it means to live and learn and socialize and parent in the digital age. And we can be very, very thankful that He knows that. And He actually sent His Holy Spirit to live in each and every one of us as we give our lives to Jesus. He fills us with His Spirit. And His Spirit actually helps us every day, moment by moment. We can hear what God is saying and we can follow. And He can navigate us through the most complex parts of life. And He can redeem the most beautiful things. He can create holy community, koinonia, both online and offline, so that we truly have nose-to-nose, face-to-face, when we're together and actually when we're digitally connected online. We can get the best of both worlds as we seek Jesus in every circumstance, in every situation as a community. And look, Jesus understands brokenness. He understands addiction. He understands distraction. He understands disappointment. He understands pain. He understands failure, which is my experience. And He also he understands joy, He understands pleasure, He understands beauty, He understands relationships, He understands laughter, which is also my experience of the Christian life and my experience of using my tools. And I'm sure yours is the same. So Remember, as we have communion, we remember that he died and he came alive again, and his spirit is in us, and he has transformed us to live in this world in a different way. And I'd like to finish by saying I've reflected that we often say that Jesus loves you, which is absolutely true. He's alive and he loves you. He loves every single one of us individually, and he's forgiven us and he's transformed us. But Jesus also likes us. As silly as that picture was before, we often forget that Jesus does like us, that he is a friend of sinners and that he is our friend, that he actually wants to connect with you and spend time with you and laugh with you and enjoy your company close up and from a distance wherever you are, when we fall and when we stand. So all I would encourage you to do is let's not get caught up in a faux community like my faux soup. Okay, the real deal is available. It's more costly, it's rich, and it's beautiful, but God can call us into it, and our online technologies can complement them but not replace them. So let's give Jesus some time away from a screen. Let's spend time with him. Let's remember that we don't need 2,000 likes and 200 friends, because Jesus is our friend. The creator of the universe loves and likes you and I. And so as we have communion, let's reflect on what Jesus is saying, and let's do our business with him. So Jesus took bread on the night he was betrayed, and it represents his body, which is broken for us. And I love how tangible, smells like bread, and it's physical, and it's messy, just like community. And in that sense, we remember that Jesus is with us, and his bread was broken for us. And as we have the wine, we remember that Jesus' blood was poured out for us. It's real blood. It's tangible. It's real. And he did it, and he forgave us, and he loved us, and he created community. So he will navigate the best and the worst. So as we come to the communion table, and as we eat bread, and as we drink wine, I would love you to do your stuff with God. If there's stuff that God is stirring up in you, like a conviction, then repent. Say, sorry, God. I'm sorry. I've made some mistakes. And ask and receive his forgiveness, which is totally free. If there's confusion, if you enter this table and you think, God, I feel overwhelmed by that talk, and I feel overwhelmed by the world around us, then give that to him. Say, life is confusing. Please help me in that. If there's sadness and brokenness, then come to God and ask for healing, because it's a healing cup. God heals us. Say, God, I need your healing. I need your help. I need your wholeness. I need your rest. I need to be made well. And he offers that for free. And if it's simple worship, where we just adore Jesus for who he is and what he's done in our life, and let's worship him as well. So the communion cup and the communion bread is all of those things. Come with whatever God is speaking to you in. And if you'd like prayer at the end, feel free to sit on the front rows generally, and we'll pray for whatever you'd like prayer for as we worship with music afterwards. So please come when you're ready and share communion with me.